Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Title on the wall here, Nine Classic Paintings Revisited. As I think I made clear yesterday, I began my career hopefully wishing to become a painter at a very early age, 13 or 14, set out on an adventure that somehow or other my career, if not my life, would be or ought to be associated with the total excitements of visual literacy, and certainly that would be related to the long, long 8,000 years of the Western traditions of painting. Along the way, art schools in London in the 1960s, the swinging 60s, associated very much with style and fashion and pop music, which I'm sure you have some knowledge of. You went to art school and you didn't necessarily fulfill your particular original ideas for being there, but you became involved in a whole maelstrom of activity which was much about music, if you like, as it was certainly about painting. And in that particular environment, of course, cinema was very important. We're talking about the year, let's say 1960, 61, 62. The Nouvelle Vague was in full swing just across the channel in Paris. The middle period of exciting post-Italian neorealism was also maturing very rapidly. So it was a very exciting, heady time to be associated with all the visual arts. And of course, most art schools in London, and there were quite a number of them, all had their own film clubs, and there was an avid excitement about what seemed to be in the air about new languages. Very rapidly, I became embroiled and excited about that, and spent as much time, I suppose, pursuing notions of theory and practice in cinema language as I did in the activities which I was primarily supposed to be there for, which was painting. But this seesaw, this combination of the still image and the moving image, has remained with me ever since. And though perhaps I am more popularly known, though I do think popularly ought to be used with a certain amount of circumspection, there is a way that the moving image, I think, is more associated with my name, perhaps, than ideas of the still image. I still paint. I have an exhibition at this very moment in Locarno in Switzerland. I'm about to have a big exhibition in Poland. There's an exhibition also coming up in Milan very shortly. I say this in order, again, to make a representation of the general overview of my excitements in these fascinating media. But I've long been perplexed and maybe disenchanted by the sophistications of 8,000 years of Western painting. Let's bring that down a bit to make it more manageable. Let's say the first maybe recognizable painting activity of the modern age could start, shall we say, about 60 AD. That's relative, of course, to the explosion in Pompeii, which preserved so much Roman wall painting. So we take that as our fixture and beginning. So let's not say 8,000, which is a bit amorphous, although there's evidence, of course, that it exists, but let's say 2,000. So let's talk about 2,000 years of extraordinary painting pursuits in Europe, mainly, of course, Western Europe, in association with much more recent figures of 115 years of cinema, as we suggested yesterday, if we indeed believe that cinema began in 1895. So this imbalance of 2,000 years of intense activity of the manufacture of the still image as against this 115 years of cinematic practice. There are, I suppose, bogus ways of making this comparison, which are in some ways unsatisfactory, but I'm very much aware that I am heir to both of those traditions, and we're all now on the cusp, whatever our degrees of nostalgia about ideas of cinema, and whether that were pessimism or optimism, we look forward to what will happen afterwards in cinema practice. There seems to me to be very much a situation here about the total phenomenon of the idea of visual literacy. Umberto Eco had said that for 2,000 years, if not 8,000 years, the world has been ruled and organized by the text masters. Now, post the digital revolution, there is a way that so many activities, replacements, reconsiderations of the notions of knowledge, that the text masters, after 2,000 years, have to move aside and allow the image masters, and now we hope also mistresses, who were never particularly privileged before, to come forward and now make a stamp and develop our notions about civilizing attitudes, about communications, etc., etc. I'd always thought that if you wanted to be, shall we say, sophisticatedly visually literate, then the cinema would be the ideal place for you. Vitruvius once said that the best education a gentleman can have, and remember the Romans were gentlemen just like the English, there is a way in which the education you ought to take on would be the education given to an architect. Because an architect has to know so much about so many things. Has to know about building materials, has to know about mathematics, has to know about social conditions, has to have a sense of historical continuity, has to have an understanding of aesthetics and certainly finance and certainly politics. A completely rounded out, very large, wide-parametered education. There's a curiosity there, though, that in a curious way he also added that maybe it might be an extraordinary education for a generalist notion of a civilized gentleman, but in some curious way it might be very disadvantageous if in fact, indeed, you wanted to become an architect. I often feel, or would like to believe, that that could be regarded as a situation for the filmmaker. A filmmaker, ideally, as a total personification of what all that means, should presumably have all the attributes in the education that would have afforded the notion of the Vitruvian architect. But in a curious way, by having all that knowledge, again, rather like the position of the architect, it almost stops you from making cinema. This must be not an uncommon experience for maybe many of you. When I went to art school bubbling with excitement to learn how to do it, the first maybe 6 months that bubbling enthusiasm lasted. But after I'd been at art school for 4 years, I couldn't paint for another five. It had somehow sucked all the lifeblood out. The academical concern, the self-criticism, the peer group pressure meant you entirely lost your bubbling, excited, enthusiastic sophistication and enjoyment. So in a curious way, painting suddenly became a chore and a job and not an enjoyment. I'm very much aware of those sorts of phenomenon, but I do think that if that is my particular experience, the ability to be able to manipulate visual literacy in terms of cinema in association with painting gradually, as it were, increased my confidence, and I began, in a sense, to be able to practice both those things. Do we have, and I think I tried to argue this somewhat yesterday, do we in fact have an image-conscious cinema? Do we have an image-based cinema? And I would argue with you, though it would be very good if you could possibly find me examples contrary to this idea, that practically every film that's ever been made starts its life as a text, and there is an extraordinary, very strong umbilical cord that connects the whole concept of the cinema of the world, not just of the West, not just of the East, but of the world, in association with the notions of the bookshop. Cinema knows this because it always goes back to the bookshop, essentially, for its ideas. Let me posit this notion also to you, which might, again, have a much larger general consideration, but I feel very much in the cinema there are far too many conductors and by no means enough composers. The conductors indeed can be very talented, but the actual original creative association of a filmmaker with his material on a one-to-one primary artistic basis is comparatively rare. Now, that isn't the general feeling that we have by and large about painting. And also there's the phenomenon about the notion of the group and the notion of the individual. There is, of course, Gilbert and George, which tend to break down the situation, but most painters work alone, often in a very lonely situation. So many of my colleagues gave up painting a long, long time ago because it's such a solitary, private occupation. Filmmaking, of course, gives you as much as you would want in terms of gregariousness, and for me, sometimes far too much gregariousness. I really wish that I could make films entirely on my own, but it is totally and absolutely impossible. You could, of course, bring in the whole phenomenon of the notion of the Academy, and talking about Rembrandt, which I hope to talk a bit more in a minute. He had, I think, at least 25 very famous pupils and a whole series of apprentices and assistants. So the notion that he himself, for example, entirely on his own, made the night watch is probably erroneous. Continuing again, and there are many, many different ways to look at this, but my anxieties and associations led me to believe that the sophistications of painting over such a long period of time, in the end, were going to be far more rewarding to the visually literate than perhaps anything of equivalent nature that had been provided by cinema. Now, I hope to hear some groans in the audience after that statement, but there's still a feeling that the notions of sophistication, of contemplation, of rumination, of layers of meaning, of a sense of continuity, how all these painters belong to one glorious club, that Henry Moore reworks Michelangelo, that Picasso reworks Velázquez, and we can go on making those sorts of examples, in some curious way is neither as fixed or as profound or as satisfactory when you come to look for the equivalent sorts of circumstances in cinema. So all these anxieties and all this, I suppose, disenchantment about the practice which I am most closely associated with continually throws me back all the time to the pursuit of visual literacy in painting. For any of you who know my cinema, of course, I try extremely hard all the time to keep this history in mind and want to make extremely visually well-wrought films, so that nothing is accidental. These aren't a series in my cinema of Polaroid, accidental, happenstance images. Everything is deliberately decided upon. Everything is pre-planned. Some people, of course, far too much. Plan far too much. Greenaway is anally retentive, says Time Out. I make no apologies for that. I think you, the audience, deserve to be able to be brought in to all the visual arguments possible, whether you're particularly interested in Jackson Pollock or Caravaggio or Giotto. In some curious way, it's part of all our birthright. It's all part of the inheritance of who we are. There's two phrases. Derrida suggests that the image always has the last word, and I think it was Lamartine who suggested that just because you've got eyes doesn't mean to say you can see. So with all these different ideas, we have embarked, I suppose, on a consideration of making a dialogue, I suppose, between the visual literacies of cinema and the visual literacies of painting. It all began, by no means as self-consciously as I've just explained it, by the fact that Rembrandt celebrated his 400th birthday in the year 2006. He's born in 1606. Rembrandt is a great Dutch hero. I live in the center of Amsterdam. When I look out my attic window, I can look straight into the Rijksmuseum, which you might know is the home of the National Collection of Dutch Art. And the Rijksmuseum was built in the 1860s, large Victorian mid-19th century building, and it is almost arranged like a temple or a Gothic cathedral of art, and right where the altarpiece is, they have hung, at least now for 150 years, Rembrandt's The Night Watch. Very powerful painting, which says an awful lot about Dutch manners, Dutch costume, Dutch attitudes to servants, sexual attitudes, actions towards notions of still life, of the tableau vivant, but also about ideas of conviviality. There is a Dutch word, gezellig, almost untranslatable into English, because all the words we try to translate it with are rather embarrassing to the English. The one that's most used is coziness, which sounds very petty bourgeois, doesn't it? What I like to translate it with is some notion, perhaps far more pompously, of course, that gezellig really means domestic solidarity. The Dutch love to be together. They find every single excuse to make clubs, to make societies, to get together. Not necessarily over a drink or a meal, but this very clubbable nation. I think there are lots of good reasons for that. There's only 16 million of them, and our country's very small, and they've had to spend an awful lot of time fighting the sea. One man, two men, one farmer and three cows and four children, two villages, three towns. Impossible for such small numbers to take on the sea, which they absolutely have to do. I have a house in Amsterdam, and its front door is 3.5 meters below sea level. Not that I actually feel threatened, but there's always that feeling that at least a third of most of Holland, certainly north of Maastricht, is all below sea level. And with that as a suggestion, there is it's not particularly sung, and people don't go around with furrowed brows, but there is this notion that unless you are extremely wary of what might happen, you're all going to end up in very considerable danger. The ice caps are melting. The circulation of the streams of water in the English Channel are all changing. There is a worst-case scenario that Amsterdam will be with us no more in the year 2039, and that's not very far off. The Dutch, though, I suppose, are extremely able at dealing, because they've had such long practice with the sea, that maybe half of England will disappear before the Dutch actually succumb. Whenever there's a sea disaster or water disaster, like New Orleans flooding, for example, like the disappearance of Russian submarines, like the creation of the new harbour in Dubai, you will find the Dutch there busily working away and organising their great experience in terms of hydraulics. They're now building another new airport out into the sea. All their electrical situations based upon wind power, these great wind farms that are now posited in the North Sea. So even if the date of 2039 should be very wary, I'm sure that the Dutch will be extremely prepared. I'm telling you all this because all these ideas are related in a curious way, looking backwards to history, with this extraordinary painting by Rembrandt called The Night Watch. So in 2006, we celebrate this painting, and we celebrate, you see, we already. I'm not Dutch. What do I mean by we? It's because I identify so much with, I think, this extraordinary, rich, and profoundly political democratic republic. Certainly since 1648, the first really major power-sharing democracy in the whole of Europe, surrounded by really absolute monarchists who are not particularly prepared to even allow this little Dutch Republic to exist. And that maybe is what the Night Watch is all about. It's a celebration of the Dutch fighting the Spanish, the Habsburgs, who are lodged in Madrid and have a large empire that stretches over at least two-thirds of Europe and are trying very hard to hold the notion of Holland in their grip. Are there any Spanish people in the room? Because I'm about to insult you. The Spanish are lousy with money. They have been lousy with money for at least 500 years. And they're lousy with money, as you well know, all over again. They have certain virtues, which we can talk about at a later stage. But when you think they had this huge amount of opportunities with all this huge amount of gold and silver that came from South America, flooded across the Caribbean and all the way across the Atlantic to land on the shores of Europe, but they lost most of it. They lost most of it, of course, to the Dutch, first of all, and then the English. And then what did finally survive and ended up in Spain, in a curious way, was wasted, disappeared. And very, very quickly, the great Spanish Empire began to deteriorate. So certainly by about 1750, it was deeply, deeply impoverished. But on the other hand, first of all, Holland and then England were immensely rich, which had really seconded, had stolen, had found ways that all that gold coming from South America, intended for Portugal and Spain, had found its way much further up the European coast. But the Dutch fought the Spanish, a long, savage and very bitter civil war with the Spanish Habsburgs for about 70 years. And there was a long, long tradition of military prowess and pride, which the rich burghers of Amsterdam were very, very keen to see replicated in painting. There's a long tradition going back to probably about 1530 of these sorts of paintings. And at the very tail end of this tradition, when the Spanish power had weakened and the threat was no longer really very serious, along comes Rembrandt to make an extraordinary painting, which we now know erroneously as The Night Watch. I say erroneously because Rembrandt never ever knew that painting by that title. So to make a celebration then for all these notions of gazelics, domestic solidarity, a sense of identity, fighting the sea, comradeship, conviviality, are all poured into this canvas. It's quite large. And as I said, it's the center point of the biggest art gallery collection in Holland. So in the year 2006, everybody is celebrating the Dutch Golden Age, and certainly Rembrandt and certainly the Night Watch. There were exhibitions about Rembrandt's mother. There were exhibitions about Rembrandt's dog. I'm also told, though I can't prove it, that there were exhibitions about the fleas on the back of Rembrandt's dog. It became obsessional. On the morning of Rembrandt's birthday, something like 5,000 people poured into the gardens of the Rijks Museum and were treated to a meal of brown bread and raw herring. And they kept coming back and they kept coming back until all the kitchens were totally exhausted. There was this great sense of celebration. It is known, I suppose, and I don't think and hope that this is vainglorious, because I've been living now in Holland for at least 16 years and working there for much longer, that my cinema is very much interested in artificial light, which is, I suppose, in a sense, a perfect definition of cinema. Cinema maybe is no more than the practice of the manipulation of artificial light, first of all in its manufacture, and then when you project it again. And for whatever else I suppose people know Rembrandt about, he's known to be, as well, my God, that sounds a little arrogant, doesn't it, as well, but he's certainly known to be a master manipulator of artificial light. There are four people who are very interested for the very first time, thanks to the new technologies of candle making, which suddenly became ubiquitous. And before, I suppose, about 1590, the only people who could afford to have wax candles were the church and the aristocrats. There aren't many aristocrats in Holland anyway. But after that particular date, around about 1590, certainly in Western Germany, the notion of the tallow candle came into being and certainly entertained a whole mass of Golden Age Dutch painters who began very, very seriously to paint in conditions of artificial light. There was a precedent, of course, that Caravaggio, who's dead around about 5 to 10, Rembrandt's born in 1606, so their lives do just overlap, who had, of course, excited the whole of the Western world, enormous influence of Caravaggio in terms of artificial light and the way it's manipulated and organized. I always think that's particularly fascinating because it's now thought that Caravaggio was red colorblind. He couldn't distinguish between red and black. Witness the particular way he made his paintings. That theory, of course, can be applied to so many other painters. You know, El Greco had anamorphis. That's why he saw everything long and straight. Who else? Titian had cataracts. That's why everything's out of focus. So you find a physiological excuse for a particular artistic vision. It's a great game to play. So there was then, making a connection between my particular interest in artificial light, using very state-of-the-art contemporary photography in a post-cinema notion, the digital revolution, and to make, as it were, comparisons. And they suggested that maybe I should be commissioned to make an installation, exhibition, comment, dialogue with this very, very famous painting in the notions again about light. First thing I said, yes, by all means, I would be deeply, deeply honored. But what I want to do is I want to show extremely, I want to project extremely bright lights on this incredible painting called The Night Watch, which is totally uninsurable. The national newspaper said, the Rice Museum gives a foreigner the night watch to play with. Enormous amounts of antagonism and dubiety about the whole situation. But courageously, the directors of the Rice Museum went ahead. And myself and my compatriots and people I work with in cinema, who again were magnificent at organizing situations of light, we labored for about 3 months at nighttime in the Rice Museum, creating means for a projection of a certain sort of masking techniques on the original painting. Let me just explain to you how valuable this painting is. Just after the war, as you know, your country, the Marshall Plan, tried to bail Europe out economically after the devastation of the Nazis. Holland was extremely badly stricken by the Second World War, and the huge amounts of American money that were poured into Holland to re-liven the economics quickly created a situation whereby the Dutch owed America huge sums of money and couldn't even pay back the interest. The incumbent American president at that time sort of clapped his hands, apparently, and said, okay, we have a plan. We will give you, Holland, complete freedom from all your debts if you give us Rembrandt's The Night Watch. And happily, of course, by no means, said the Dutch, you're never going to get your hands on that. The Dutch, of course, being very industrious people, within about 5 or 6 years were beginning to pull themselves out of the situation anyway. But that gives you some idea of how this painting is so very, very important to them. I've given you some clues then to a background, which I think is very, very relevant to some of the ideas that we did. We were certainly given permission. I contemplated night after night that night watch as myself and my colleagues worked on these projection activities. I tell you another amusing story. You know how pragmatic the Dutch are. When we first went there, we had 4 policemen, 3 art historians, and 2 dogs to watch what we did. The second week, we only had 1 policeman. The dogs had gone, and the art historians, of course, had loped off a long time before. But the third week, they gave me the key to the Rice Museum. Let me show you straight away the sort of things that we played with, that we organized in the manufacture of something that was going to be much, much greater than we ever dared imagine. Here it comes.
Zorg dat hij dus er zijn hier oude knappen die lijken van
As you can see, we flooded the painting. We burned the painting. If you look very carefully, we also covered all the flood, all the bottom part of the painting in blood. Any of you who are familiar with Amsterdam know that Amsterdam's are represented by three crosses of St. Bartholomew, and they are supposedly to represent the potential disasters that could happen to that city. In English, we can talk about fire, flood, and the flea. The flood, as I've said, most of Amsterdam's below sea level, so it's always in danger of being flooded. So we created our artificial flood here on the most expensive and the most famous and celebrated of all their paintings. And certainly before about 1600, the city, very largely like most European cities in Northern Europe, were made of wood. And there were constant fires, very largely created before the advent of lightning rods, invented by your countryman, Mr. Franklin. Cathedrals, of which there are many in Amsterdam, and churches were constantly catching on fire. The third one, fire, flood, and flea, is a bit apocryphal because the citizens of Holland or anywhere else in the world never realized this, but the city port, obviously Amsterdam's almost on the seaboard, constantly visited by vermin from other countries, and there's a series of very bad plagues created by the flea on the back of the black rat, which swept across Holland at least five times between 1613 and about 1672. We can make this very personalized because most of Rembrandt's children and certainly two of his three consorts all succumbed to the plague. So as a reminder, in a sense, we've used a trope here to not only flood the painting, set it on fire, but to make a representation, a notion of the pest or the plague. You can also see, inevitably, there's a certain sort of dawn to dusk narrativity to take us through. We are doing strange things. We are giving, first of all, a still image, a painting, a soundtrack, and we're giving it a sense of longevity, a sense of time, and we want to be able to engage you over about a period of 7 minutes in the notion of this being a highly theatrical work. To make that really apparent, we created a tribune, a series of ramped seats. There were actually 34 of them because there are 34 people in the painting. So 34 people could sit down and watch 34 people, in a sense, in the fixed image. And the image, as I've tried repeatedly in lots of other artworks associated with this painting, is to make indeed the notion of the Night Watchers a very theatrical, posed, and organized history painting in the tradition of Italian and French history painting, but very much a theatrical event. Having spent then so many nights contemplating this and working on it, I began to examine all the particularities of the painting and certainly began to read the huge amount of literature. The Night Watch went on show in a celebrated guardroom association in association with the military guilds of Amsterdam virtually before the varnish was dried. Now, this means that the painting itself has been seen by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in a public position for a very, very long time. That's pretty unusual outside of religious painting in churches. It's only, and we tend to forget this, it's only since about the middle or the latter part of the 19th century that most of the paintings we're now extremely familiar with actually came out into the open. The streets and houses were full of extraordinary paintings. British ambassador comes back from Amsterdam to report to his colleagues in London, absolutely amazed that the average Dutch home has so many paintings in it. It is reckoned that over 2 million paintings were painted in Amsterdam alone. Let's forget Delft, let's forget Rotterdam. 2 million paintings were painted from the birth of Rembrandt, 1606, to the death of Vermeer, which is about 1672. It's an awful lot of paintings. And it also indicates, therefore, that an awful lot of households were supported by this activity. The idea, then, of trying to bring together notions, let me refer back to what I said initially, about what cinema does and how it operates and what we ask of it, and its questions of literacy, and what painting does. So painting and cinema, in some curious way, ought to be able to share a certain sort of dialogue. We ought to be able to talk to one another. And cinema, surely, and painting already is absolutely proven, and both you and I can think of lots of examples, are cross-sharing references and associations and sophistications. The exhibition was very successful. There were detractors. I remember one German gentleman came and shook me by the lapel and said, "How dare you interfere with a Rembrandt masterpiece?" I think, you know, every generation uses the tools of its time in order to understand the significance of everything around. And I think that all those people, certainly the laptop generation, and they came in their thousands to watch what we were doing, the laptop generation who would be aware of Spider-Man, would be aware, Avatar wasn't made then, but certainly things like well, all those famous, you know, superabundant technological marvels that we've seen in the cinema for the last 10 years. So, in a curious way, why should the devil have all the best tunes? Let's allow the laptop generation to understand that what they're familiar with in the cinema and at their fingertips with their laptop can actually be used as a vocabulary to be able to examine these extraordinary masterpieces of the past, which are, in a sense, stepping stones, like Andy Warhol could not exist before Mark Rothko. Rothko couldn't exist before, well, you name it, you can play this game very easily. And there are a whole significant number of paintings which have been absolutely instrumental in the way the continuity of painting and cinema, if we want to talk about a sharing of visual literacy, that have happened certainly since the Renaissance. We had a lot of distinguished visitors. The people came from the Uffizi, people came from the Brera, people came from the National Gallery. They were curious about what we were doing, and maybe a bit surprised by the audacity and the freedoms, certainly, that the Rijksmuseum directors had permitted us. So we began to get invitations. And one of those invitations was in association with that famous Dan Brown painting in Milan at Santa Maria del Grazia called The Last Supper. But before I get on to show you how we developed our vocabulary, the actual pursuit of examining this painting with all its mysteries, and art historians have at least counted over 50 mysteries in this painting, have somehow perplexed a general overview of how we are to see it vis-a-vis ideas of Rembrandt's appreciation of what he thought he was doing. In association with this demonstration, this so-called projection, though I hesitate to use those sorts of words because this is obviously not a film, it's obviously obviously not an animation. It certainly uses projection techniques, but in itself it's not a projection because we are projecting, if you like, on the actual original painting. I have to keep reminding you what you see here is a poor representative DVD played off a laptop. It doesn't really in any way match the magic and the excitement to be able to look at this painting with this, if you like, contemporary interference. You're all familiar, I'm sure, with the Stendhal syndrome. You know, Stendhal supposedly fainted when he saw a Fra Angelica, I think it was, in Florence for the first time. And ever afterwards, when people swoon or faint in front of a work of art, it's known as the Stendhal syndrome. When a little later we decided to make a film, a feature film about all these activities, we invited Vivienne Westwood, she familiar to you, very celebrated English designer, to come and design the costumes for us. She'd never been to the Rice Museum before, so I took her by the hand and said, come and have a look at this. Well, she didn't actually suffer from Stendhal syndrome. She didn't swoon, but she started giggling, and I couldn't stop her giggling for half an hour. There was something about the actual real physical presence, which curiously you are very familiar with through reproduction, chocolate boxes, tea towels, and all that phenomenon. But then to be presented with a real thing is some curious cultural shock. Anyway, in association with all this information we gathered together, we made a sort of prologue halfway through the exhibition in order to help people to understand how perhaps they might look at it. Let me show you this film. There is a conspiracy painted in Rembrandt's The Night Watch. The sinister title of the painting alone suggests we should look for it. And we should listen, too, to the painting's soundtrack. Amongst all the hullabaloo, the dogs barking, the drummer drumming, the clattering of 13 pikes, the hallowing of Manning Cock, the loudest sound is of a musket shot. You can see the flames of the firing bursting forth behind the head of the foreground, shining figure in yellow. Where did the bullet go? We should investigate, and when we do, with a little ingenious adventuring, we can see that the whole gaudy endeavor of this painting is going to stir up trouble. It is Rembrandt's great subversive act, Rembrandt's indictment of a conspiracy and a murder. The characters in the drama have assembled inside and outside the painting to gain and to suffer from the murder of the company's former leader, Captain Piers Hasselberg. The motive is money and power for the new captain, Franz Banning Koch, and his associates to lead the company of musketeers at the visit of Mary Stuart, daughter of King Charles I of England, who seeks to pawn the English crown jewels in Amsterdam to find money to fight his parliament in England's coming civil war. The main conspirators are Banning Koch, the captain, Willem van Reutenberg, his lieutenant, Vischer, the standard bearer, and the two sergeants at arms, Engelin and Kemp. Six other officers are directly party to the act, and all 16 of them stand to gain financially. The killing is described as a military accident. The official verdict is accidental death. But Rembrandt believes otherwise, and he investigates. He accused Banning Koch and Willem van Reutenberg of conspiring to kill. He accused Jonkind of aiming the musket. He found Horatio Aitken, the underaged musketeer, blackmailed into pulling the trigger. Such a public indictment in a painting hung in such a public space as the Musketeers' headquarters for all to see was bound to create a reaction. And it did. Rembrandt, always an outsider and riding boldly on the successes of his first years in Amsterdam, was unlikely to succeed in indicting these men. And they took their revenge. The Bennekom conspirators took away their patronage and persuaded others to do likewise. Within a few years, the decline in Rembrandt's social and financial fortunes is noticeable and clearly will not be reversed. Goetje's destructive attachment to Rembrandt's household seems like an organized subterfuge on the part of his enemies. The selective accusations of Henriques whoredom before the Reformed Church, the repudiation of the Amsterdam Town Hall Commission, and the dubious steps taken to avoid bankruptcy that are blocked and counterblocked all seem like maneuverings brought both separately and collectively to discredit Rembrandt as Amsterdam's citizen and painter. Rembrandt's J'accuse was never forgiven by his enemies.
Okay, there's the basic sketch, which gradually became more convoluted, more examined, as the development of all the extraordinary mysteries in the painting, which I've already suggested there were over 50, needed very much exploring. And eventually, they all came together, and we found the finance, basically in Holland, of course, to make a feature film to explain the night watch, as indeed suggested by that commentary. It really is a painting of a conspiracy and a murder. We plunged ahead and found our Rembrandt. See if you agree if this man is fulfilling your ideas of what Rembrandt looked like.
So, we all know that you are now a rich man. But tell me, how come a painter can be a rich man?
Hard work often makes money.
By painting, daubing. Oh, come on. Hmm? Fixing colored paste to Kemp with the hairs from dogs. You may be rich, but what about wealthy?
God damn it. I'll do it. Stop you sulking.
I'm not sulking. And do what?
The goddamned painting of the militia pretending to be mighty soldiers.
Oh, that.
What? What do you mean, oh, that? I thought that was what you wanted. God damn it. It was your idea. You've put me up to this.
I want 9 months. That's a human gestation period. If it takes that long to make a baby, it will certainly take that long to make a painted army.
Doesn't take that long to make a baby. It takes 10 seconds at the most.
To you, maybe. But for me, with all the right dimples and curls, it takes 5 seconds. Shall we?
Goetje!
Let me draw you.
No.
But, darling, let me stay.
You must go. This is a private time. I'm not drawing a painting. So what the hell am I? Just an excuse for a bloody tour.
How can it be a private time? It's our child. We made it.
Get out. Go.
Look what we found for you. She's a present. I need a good position in that painting. No Holland corner stuff. And if I don't look like I would like to look like...
Babies need to be provided for life, always. What happens if you lose your eyes? Become blind.
Rembrandt may be cock of the roost just now, but he's unstable.
For God's sake, let me start that again. I'll end up on the floor.
Someone so disadvantaged is going to work very hard to please.
I insist we wear these. I'm paying, for God's sake.
This, wrong colour. Too dull and no shine.
How's the painting?
All right.
What's that supposed to mean?
All right.
Oh, come on.
It's all right.
Do you ever pose for him? You know, without any clothes on.
What will you do if I die?
You're not going to die.
What will you do when I die?
I could die before you.
Then where would we be?
Stay still. I'll give you the drawing.
Then why do it?
For the pleasure of drawing.
How's the painting?
It's almost finished.
Then I can go.
What?
Well, I only stayed around long enough to see you finish the job. I encourage you to start.
You're not going anywhere. Never. Never.
The calling out of the militia for the 7th Company of the Musketeers, Amsterdam.
We are meant to be the militia coming to defend the city, and we look like a bunch of out-of-work actors trying on a wardrobe. I say, let's burn the f***ing thing.
Fire!
As you know, there's almost a sub-genre in films about artists and films about painters. And I suppose we would always agree that a large amount of them are not really about the painter's art at all, but about the painter's sex life. I am not, as you can see, completely innocent of that phenomenon. But I do wish to be able to make correspondences between the domestic life and the personal life of this man living in the middle of the 17th century, in association with what he painted. The feature film was made, traveled around the world, still doing, as it were, duty in far-flung cinemas in Terra del Fuego or Baghdad. No, maybe not Baghdad, but certainly in Terra del Fuego. But there was so much information and so many associations and so much to talk about and so much in a curious way to glorify mid-17th century Holland, which literally did for about three generations become the center of the world. You could say that Amsterdam was the very extreme western end of the Silk Road, and after all, wasn't New York originally called New Amsterdam, and didn't Peter the Great build St. Petersburg very much based upon the ground plans of Dutch cities? So the influence, indeed, of Dutch culture and life and society and politics were profound, absolutely so profound, that in the end, England stole practically everything from Holland and succeeded on Holland's back to ultimately become the great power that it did. So it was a curious thing that both Holland had an empire and so did the English. But the conditions at home in England were so bad that the people who were sent abroad to organize the empire in an English situation never came back. But conditions were so good in Holland, you couldn't keep your younger sons away. And the Dutch empire almost collapsed through lack of manpower because the Dutch were so incredibly happy to return as quickly as they could. Absolutely no space to show you this, but let me just show you the trailer for the documentary we made, which again embraces some of the things I've just been talking about. This building is the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, Holland, the home of the prime collection of Dutch paintings. The Rijksmuseum is currently the scene of a shooting.
Where did the bullet go?
I accuse you, gentlemen, of murder.
They shot Hasselberg! Someone shot Hasselberg!
man is dead, shot through the right eye. The relevant authorities should investigate. The night watch has been endlessly scrutinized, examined, and contemplated, and considered to be full of mysteries, into which Rembrandt has scrupulously painted an indictment of guilt.
And I want 9 months, human gestation period. If it takes that long to make a baby, it will certainly take that long to make a painted army.
Hey!
My husband was certain that everyone in the painting stands accused.
It is imperative that we reopen the case. You must be well aware of the American television miniseries CSI, Crime Scene Investigated. Well, this is my CSI of 1642. Forensic examination of the evidence, which is all contained minutely without any distortion in that painting, which has been extracted and examined and organized in a sense to support my advocacy for this case of conspiracy and murder. I always believe that there's no such thing as history. There are only historians. There are no such thing as art historians. There is no such thing as art history. There's only art historians. It's all up for grabs. What is more important, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon or Ridley Scott's Gladiator? Are we interested in the mythology or are we interested in the history? I suggest to you we're always far more interested in the mythology than the history. And it's the mythology that gets handed down, associated, of course, with some notion of historical truth, if we ever know what that is. But as Foster said, there is no way we can visit history. It is an unvisitable country. So in a curious way, we're all up for grabs to interpret the information that does arrive in our direction. Again, can't show you the documentary, we don't have time. Let me press on then to the enthusiasm with which our installation at the Rice Museum was received, and indeed we did were asked to come and examine the possibilities of having a look at Da Vinci's The Last Supper and seeing again if we could provide it with a relevance to contemporary notions of the post-digital revolution, make it relevant, I suppose, to the imaginations of the laptop generation, and be able in some ways to revitalize or to bring up to date all sorts of ideas about its meaning, about its composition, about its organization, about its materials, about its politics, etc. Now, Da Vinci's The Last Supper is a rather different proposition. You probably know that Leonardo da Vinci used all sorts of new techniques, very experimental painter. And I think Vasari, the art historian, said within 15 years of Da Vinci finishing the painting, it was already falling off the wall. And it's been falling off the wall ever since. When you visit it, you have to be vacuumed down to get rid of all the dust. You know that, was it 70% of all domestic dust is human skin? The human skin flying around from visitors, settling in all the little tiny pores of the plaster on which the painting is painted, gradually and very slowly over long years of time, creates a very mild sort of acid rain, which corrupts the painting in a sense from within. Many, many restorers, more than 20, have tried over the last three centuries to do something about this, often with disastrous results. And a lot of people say there isn't now any more a single mark made by Da Vinci on that particular wall. Our examination of it, though, it began again, I suppose, in the parallel way that we examined the painting in all its sort of research and its physical nature and its history, to finally produce a notion which was very interesting for all sorts of reasons that are related to contemporary technology. First of all, it made me believe that we can now safely say that reproductions of great paintings are often far better than the originals. Now, to some of you, that might be absolute anathema. But there is a way we can now clarify and look at paintings by the careful and, of course, subtle and respectful examination of reproductions in order to elucidate and bring out their meaning, not only to, as it were, recover the years of history and neglect, but also in some curious way, dare I say this, to correct notions of vision as we would understand it in the 21st century. But to examine the Da Vinci Last Supper is almost to ask the question, is this painting a fake original, or is it an original fake? And that sets up all sorts of really interesting questions about the notion of iconic art. Why do we prize the original? I'm supposed to be involved with cinema. Where is the original negative, or what's the original phenomenon of Gone with the Wind? You can talk about an original painting. Can you talk about an original film? We're all in the age of mass reproduction. There is a way in which these notions of what is real, what is fake. I mean, you know the statue of Marcus Aurelius on the Capitoline Hill, fake. You know that the four horses on the front of St. Mark's in Venice, fakes. I bet you the Mona Lisa is really kept in a Japanese bank somewhere, and we have a facsimile hanging on the wall in the Louvre. But this does throw up, again, these investigations, all sorts of questions about how we realize what our museums are for. What do we feel that the collections are for? You know, there's a notion that all our museums, certainly in Europe, only hold about 3% of what man made. What on earth happened to the other 97%? And isn't it, thank God, a good job we've lost it, because where the hell would we put all this stuff? And now in the digital age, you know, you can't keep Dickens or the equivalent of Umberto Eco's letters anymore because he made them on a computer. We have to find new ways of organizing what we think is valuable, what we want to save, and how we want to save it. Okay, so I just want to make a demonstration to you that the actual process of making a reassessment of these paintings from the post-digital position throws up so many exciting offshoots and opportunities to make new strategies and new agendas. But let me show you what we actually did to this incredible, precious masterpiece. Thank you. to remind you that what you're seeing here, of course, again, is a DVD three times removed in quality, seen via a laptop through a beamer in an audience like this. To be able to posit notions of an animated Night Watch in Holland are rather different from doing the same thing on an act of pilgrimage in a still largely significant Roman Catholic country who still believes that the Last Supper indeed is an act of worship is, of course, largely very different. The amount of diplomacy and organization that we had to go through to do this, of course, was enormous. In the end, we had to get Mr. Berlusconi's signature as a final affidavit to give us the permission. There were conferences and art historian arguments in Rome, in Florence, in Venice and Milan. But eventually we did finally get this particular one-to-one dialogue, and we were indeed allowed to make a certain limited amount of projections on the original. But in order to open this up, and in order to make dialogue and our desire to expand upon post-digital understandings that might be brought to bear on a significant work like this, we made a clone. We made a facsimile. Now, my heart dropped here, so we have a reproduction. What sort of relationship would that possibly have to an original? Well, I have to say we brought in again here enormous amounts of extraordinary contemporary technology, and we collaborated with a series of people in Madrid, and we did make a clone, exactly the same size, and the clone was scrupulously manufactured on a plaster surface, artificial plaster surface, that tried very, very hard to reproduce the actual plaster surface that exists in the refectory in Santa Maria del Grazia. If the actual decay is part indeed of the historical process that we understand the painting to, that was all bought in. A huge number of people were magnificently persuaded, in fact, that our clone was the real thing. Let me tell you a little anecdote. There's a famous Italian art guru on Italian television who swore he had an instrument which he called an aura meter. A meter that measured the aura coming off a painting. He took this aura meter to the Sistine Chapel, where, as you know, Michelangelo's done one or two things, and he held it up, and of course the aura meter registered 97, 98. He brought his aura meter to our clone of the Last Supper and held it up in front, and he swore that his aura meter measured 110. An apocryphal story, but certainly we were all incredibly, incredibly impressed by this. And it seemed to be a way to go forward, because obviously you cannot move the Last Supper from its place of residence. You know, it's a fixture. And people were stupid enough to try and move it once upon a time, but hastily realized they were doing no good at all and pushed it all back again. But it is interesting, just that significance. If we have a painting that's put exactly where it was intended to be, that is relevant, and again, all sorts of amazing semi-mystical apocrypha get talked about in this painting. The perspective lines of the actual painting itself are continued down the refectory and out the door and across Milan and across the Alps all the way to America. And it is said that both the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building are predicated by this painting. Perhaps a little more seriously, there is, as you can see, we managed to emphasize the play of hands, all the gestures, St. Thomas with his beckoning finger, etc., and all the iconographic theological associations. And if you put all these hands together, they can make a musical stave, which plays a piece of music, which apparently was the music that was played on the reconstruction of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, which Beethoven took to form the basis for the Song of Joy. So you can see how this rumblings, the particularly maybe Italian dream of the mystic significance of this extraordinary painting. Again, I suppose the reputations we were gathering were still encouraging, and the next exercise, we were asked to go indeed to the island of San Giorgio, which is just opposite the Piazza of San Marco in Venice, to tackle an extraordinary painting by Veronese, The Marriage of Cana. I've got here an attempt to try and show you how we processed our way through all these various attempts. I think when you came in, some of you saw a sort of screensaver. Here was one of the first attempts that we decided to, because each of these paintings, having a different significance, had to be treated differently. I already mentioned that the chiaroscuro and the notions of contrast and light were very much part of the Rembrandt experience, whereas the experience, I think, of the Da Vinci is very much about space and solidity and symmetry and a sort of harmonic association of two dimensions versus three dimensions. The Veronese, a much more secular painting, witness its title, although again we made an investigation and maybe change or transmogrified a bit that notion of secularity, is to do very much with a bustling wedding scene. When you take Christian iconography, most of the imagery that we abstract from it, or painters have abstracted from it, on the whole are very negative. There are very, very few celebrations, full-hearted celebrations. Here is one, Christ's first miracle of turning the water into wine, but again with all sorts of ramifications which are theologically Byzantine and complicated, but also very, very interesting, especially if Veronese himself puts himself in the picture and began. Because he had a lot of problems with the papal inquisition, there is a great suggestion, indeed this is not at all the marriage at Cana, the wedding at Cana, but it is in fact the wedding of Christ. We made various attempts to decide what we wanted to do, again, something different to explain the particular characteristics of this painting. Here was our first idea. The idea was rejected as being too expensive and too cumbersome, so we began to pursue things in different directions. Again, building on what we had done, certainly with the Rice Museum and then again with the Da Vinci, utilizing again certain notions of other biblical stories, we finally put together a situation where this time we would give this tumultuous wedding ceremony a soundtrack, obviously related to what has been happening in cinema since 1929. So there are, I think it's 126 characters in this painting, and I wrote dialogue for them all. And when we see it, I don't think we've probably got time to see it now, but I can give you a touch. There is a way in which we have used it indeed as a complex crowd scene where everybody is discussing the wedding. But of course, this is a golden opportunity for me to use metaphor. So it's all about a prophecy and a suggestion of what's going to happen afterwards. It's an opportunity to discuss the life of Christ and the significances and notions indeed of crucifixion and the relationship of the Last Supper. So an opportunity in a sense to expand not only on, should we say, in inverted commas, the realism of a particular Jewish wedding at this particular time at a place called Cana, which in fact we don't actually know where it is and could also be mythological, and the association of all the implications of what this first miracle meant. But let me show you the particular magic we employed to enliven certainly the direct projection on this extraordinary painting. Always please remember that this is a painting of a miracle. We have made a film called The Marriage. It's about 20 minutes long, which does embrace this idea of giving this extraordinary painting a soundtrack with the characteristics I've just explained, and also various other parts of the notion of utilizing contemporary technology to begin to explain or to try and create a situation of the suspension of disbelief about the whole notion of religious miracles. Unfortunately, I do not have time to be able to show it to you. So what I'd just like to finish up is, as we advertised at the beginning of this adventure, that we are indeed doing 9 paintings, that we've had enormous amounts of invitations to a lot more, but I feel if I take any more on, I shall be doing this to the end of my life, so we really have to bring it to a conclusion. So we have selected 9 paintings which we believe to be significant as important, iconic benchmark paintings that would take us from certainly the first painting, which is represented around about 1500 by the Da Vinci, all the way up to Jackson Pollock. So we have certainly done this painting, we have shown you, and this one, and this one, and we have just recently come back from the Prado, where we are negotiating permission to be able to tackle the extraordinary, delicate, and amazing metaphorical significances of space in this amazing painting. It is suggested that up in the top right-hand corner is a most magnificent painting of emptiness, the most magnificent painting of emptiness that exists anywhere in the world. Also in Madrid, at Reina Sofia, is this famous painting, which we've now got permission to tackle, with huge amounts of problems with the politics, because you know it is really a Basque painting and should belong in Guernica, but Picasso, through some peculiar trickery, eventually ended up selling it to the Reina Sofia. We are gathering together sort of political pressure and aesthetic, I hope, senses of credibility to at least, if not, get the painting moved back to the Guggenheim in Bilbao, where maybe it ought to be, certainly to be able to create a clone, like I've explained to you, with first of all a celebration in Guernica in the spring of 2012, and then the summer to do it in the Guggenheim, and then to go to Madrid indeed and to make our projections actually on the original. You probably know about the myriad paintings that Monet made of the water lilies, and perhaps the most definitive one is in the Tuileries Gardens, the Orangerie in Paris. So we're set to do that. And then there is this painting in Chicago by Sciurra, La Grande Jatte, which we are scheduled to do probably in 2013. And then there's Jackson Pollock we've been invited to tackle. Can you imagine what the different circumstances will be, but full of extraordinary influence and interest? It is, again, a very, very large painting, very, very cinematic, indicating all sorts of notions of process and history and so on. And then, I don't know whether you read here in America, but last November, the Vatican tried to create a special relationship with all the contemporary artists of the world to try and create a situation whereby, I suppose in memory of grand commissions like Michelangelo and Julius II, to get artists to work back again in the Roman Catholic Church, full of enormous moral and ethical problems, which I don't have to underline. But the Catholic Church is still an extraordinary, amazing power base for the notions of the spread dissemination of culture. And for a long, long time, I have wished to be able to do something about this painting. And we now have 3 cardinals working very, very hard to see indeed if we can take our technology and our ideas and our theory making to be able to tackle this painting in the year 2015. Thank you for being an attentive audience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.